Last week, we were here marveling at the turn of events when David and his household began to be established. The government began to be centralized, and there was this desire in David's heart for ordered worship, unified worship at one place to look to, one place to gather, one place to pull the nation together, that it was God who desired to build and establish a firm house for David. And with all the trouble that would come, this promise, this messianic promise of an established house for David, a throne for David, would persist and continue no matter what. There was a conditional element, and we'll get into that today, but the promise holds true, and it's why we're here today, because the long-awaited Son of David is on the throne. His name is Jesus, and he is our King, and so we celebrate him foremost today. If you remember from last week, or if you weren't here, we were looking at the narrative largely through this lens of an appropriate covering. David seeking an appropriate covering for the Ark of the Covenant for worship, and also David's battles, his spiritual battle, his uncovering of Bathsheba, and her proper covering being her husband, Uriah. Interesting then, when 1 Kings starts off, 1 Kings reveals, at least in part, David's heart and his willingness amid great sin, great horrible sin, his propensity to return to the Lord, which really is what we'll be looking at today as the difference maker, the ability to return to the Lord. And I see that in the initial narrative. I'll just read you the verses, because now someone else looks to David in his old age, and they recognize that they're not able to provide him with adequate covering physically, not able to cover him enough to keep him warm. And so, maybe well-intentioned, but a really foolish action here, the people seek to bring a beautiful young woman before the king. The same type of act that brought down his house, though not the promise of his house being established, but really destroyed his home. And so let me just read that narrative quickly, just because I think it's a breath of fresh air. Now King David was old and advanced in years, and although they covered him with clothes, he could not get warm. Therefore his servant said to him, "Let a young woman be sought for my lord the king, and let her wait on the king and be in his service. Let her lie in your arms, that my lord the king may be warm." So they sought for a beautiful young woman throughout all the territory of Israel and found Abishag, the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very beautiful. This is a bad setup. And she was of service to the king and attended to him, but I don't know if you caught this in your reading, but the king knew her not. There was a turning. There was a turning that David was able to enjoy, and it's a key turn. And so as the throne passes on to David's son, David will actually warn his son in pretty clear terms not to turn away from the Lord, which would spell his son's demise. Interesting, when Solomon takes the throne is described not as the throne of Israel, which it is, or the throne of Judah, you know, the tribe more narrowly, but the throne is here and many times through Scripture referred to as the throne of David. And that might seem like a minor thing, but what that's doing is it's supposed to clue us in to God's promise all throughout. Because God's promise was to establish the house and the throne of David. And so, even though a next son is coming in line, and that'll happen repetitively, there's a constant reminder that this throne is the throne of David, because this promise was the promise given to David. And it's also juxtaposed to what happens in the north once the kingdom splits. Because what's the throne in the north? I mean, it's called the throne of Israel often there, but there's no defined house. It's not really the throne of Jeroboam or the throne of the many other family lines, because the families keep on being cut off and cut off and cut off and cut off. And so you don't have that firm promise giving you confidence throughout in the northern kingdom. What you see is treachery and death and violence and a lot of disturbing things in the north. And of course, disturbing things will reach the south, but this reminder of this being the throne of David is meant to instill confidence in the promise of God and to be reminding us of that. And we see that in a lot of ways through Scripture. Just for a quick example here, during one of the latter king's reigns, from 1 Kings 12:16, it's the same description given here, although David isn't the last king. When all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, so this is speaking of Rehoboam, so it's his throne now, the people answered the king, "What portion do we have in," they don't say Rehoboam, they say, "What portion do we have in David?" And so everybody recognizes this is David's throne and it's the promise made to David. So that's significant, but it's easy to miss. So they say, "We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse." Again, that's David. And Jeroboam, who will turn away and be given a large swath of the territory in the 10 tribes, he actually says, "To your tents, O Israel." And then he turns to Rehoboam, who's leading the throne of David, and he says, "Look now to your own house, David." And so that's just really firmly established. It's so established that when we get to the prophets and there's any talk of a kingdom hope and a messianic hope, it's always tied to David. Okay, so this is a really big, big deal. Isaiah 9:6-7. This is more common to be read at Christmas, but just to emphasize how big a theme it is. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of the peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." But amid the firmness of the promise, there is this element that we have to wrestle with, and it's this if. And so when David's instructing his son Solomon, he reminds him that, okay, there's a sure aspect of this promise. There will remain a hope of a Davidic king for all time. And yet, I'm wondering how people were working this together at the time. But the conditional element was there. And David reiterates what God had told him clearly. And he says it to Solomon. Don't forget this part of the promise. If your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness or in firmness, in truth, with all their heart, this becomes hugely thematic through Kings. Hugely thematic, if you haven't picked up on it already in your reading. With all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne. Or in the Hebrew, more literally, a man shall not be cut off. And so what we will see is that when this condition is not met, there would be a cutting off. And yet, the long promise is still established. The promise of a Davidic king who will rise. In the following narrative, when Solomon is established, he is established as king here, and he's not the most likely candidate because he's not the oldest son. Okay, so that comes back up again that we've seen repeated through the Old Testament. It's not the firstborn here who receives the blessing, but it's Solomon. And interestingly, okay, who's Solomon's mother? Okay, and so the woman who is uncovered is now going to be covered in the most amazing way by having herself protected, her name protected and carried forward, and in a way even extending sort of the life of her husband Uriah through the son. But something becomes exceedingly important here, and it's in keeping with that idea of the throne of David, and it's this idea of walking like David. Did anyone pick up on this way that kings are qualified throughout 1 Kings, if you read it? David keeps on coming up, long after he's dead. Is the king like David, or is the king like... What's the other one? Anybody know? Sometimes it'll say like his father, but right, the offset is Jeroboam, who is the one, of course, privileged to divide the kingdom, if we can say it that way. But this idea of walking like David becomes immensely important. And at the start, we have a really great start for Solomon, because Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statute of David his father. And then there's this wrinkle, and you may or may not have caught it, but only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. Now, we talked about this a little bit last week, that the worship in Israel, on the whole, was a bit messy. There's multiple high places. There's not a clearly established place of worship. And that's part of what prompts David to have the pious desire to have a centralized worship place. We could argue about whether the temple was the right picture, but to have centralized worship made a lot of sense. And now just think about Solomon as a bit as a foil, because Solomon, and part of the promise to David, is that your son will establish me a house. Okay, very clearly meaning your son's gonna build me the temple that you wanted to build. And Solomon will do that. And yet, rather than continuing in the stream of his father, of centralized worship, he's going to these other high places. The Ark of the Covenant is down the street, in the city of David here in Jerusalem. Why are you going to the other high places? What do they have to offer? And so there's a bit of a question there, and yet it's not a total defeat of his character. It doesn't, you know, approach that in the text, but it is a wrinkle here. So he's kind of walking like David. He does love the Lord, only He made offerings at the high places, and this is a foreshadowing of his split devotion. But there's still good news coming for Solomon. So Solomon is met by the Lord. And this doesn't just happen to everyone. It's a very important meeting. The Lord meets him, and he meets him at one of the high places. And so the Lord doesn't hold it against him such that he wouldn't meet with him. So he meets him at this high place in Gibeon. And if you compare this with what came before in Samuel, it was all about what the people were asking for. Now things have kind of turned around because the primary focus is what God is asking for and seeking to do for his people. First, it was what God would build for David, and it surprised him. And now the surprise is God isn't asking something of Solomon, but their first interaction is God acting as close as we come in Scripture to a genie type of God. Sort of saying to Solomon, you know, rub the lamp. What is it that you want? By the way, this at the risk of having you just run down this the rest of the day and just ignoring me, if the Lord God Almighty met with you, I didn't know how to answer this question when I first thought about it, and he asked you, ask of me anything. The most powerful being ever to exist asks you, what do you want? Just tell me one thing. What's the thing you want most? What do you answer? I'm not sure my heart's clear on that. But what David answers is a very good thing. And we might read it cynically here as, you know, he's sounding like a really pious guy. You know, oh, I'd like wisdom. But it's expressed in this scene as a really genuine request. He's a young and inexperienced king, something that Chronicles will pick up on when we see this huge swath of space given to David in his preparation for the temple. So David can't build the temple, but he gets everything ready. I mean, he goes to, there's no limit to what David will do to get this thing ready to be built. And in 1 Chronicles, he will say multiple times, my son is young and inexperienced. And Solomon, already expressing wisdom here, he asks for a great thing. He asks for wisdom, for great wisdom. And the Lord honors that, and he's pleased with that. And he pours out wisdom upon him. And there's many ways we can categorize Solomon's fame, Solomon's greatness. But the thing that's really largely played up in the text is his wisdom. It's his wisdom that is drawing people to him. By the way, what's the big thing that was drawing people to Jesus? Sure, the acts of deliverance and the casting out of demons and miraculous acts, those things were drawing attention, for sure. But what was really capturing people? His speaking with authority and his tremendous wisdom. He comes on the scene like the wisest sage who has ever spoken. And so it's this wisdom that features prominently. And the first narrative coming out of that is him making this amazingly wise judgment between these two women who are arguing about whose mom the child really is. So all of this results in good things. It's high times in Israel. In 1 Kings 4:20, we have the description, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. It sounds like an Abrahamic-like promise there, doesn't it? They ate and drank and were happy. Israel's entering the good life. They're firmly in the land. They've got a firm and clear centralized government. They've got a firm and clear centralized worship that's up and coming. And things are going well. You've got a wise, judicious king. And assets from other countries are literally just flooding in. And so that's what you get in the description, 1 Kings 4:34. The people of all nations, not just their assets, but the people themselves, people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And so it's that wisdom that's leading. And from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And sort of the peak of the glory of this kingdom is seen in the establishment of this house. This isn't necessarily unique to Israel. Okay, when you have a great king in the ancient Near East, you have a great temple as well. And so it's a big deal to have a big and glorious temple. And that's what we get. This picture doesn't give much glory, but just to give you an idea of the scale. So in the far left box there, if you can see the number 9, the inside of that, not the little cubes around it, those are the inner chambers, but just the inside, that thin rectangle, that's the temple. And it's about the size of an NBA basketball court, except it's thinner, okay? So it's a pretty big temple, but the complex around it is also massive. So the inner court, that's the number 3 that surrounds the temple, is closer to an American football field. And then you have, you know, there are different renderings of what the whole building project looked like, but you have the royal palace, you have the porches, you have all these different aspects, and so you have a greater outer court that surrounds this whole thing. And so this is just a massive, glorious project, and people recognize it. And the thing that doesn't look very big on this map, but it's a big deal, is the number 10. It's right in front of the temple there. And what you might be able to tell is that from the internal measurements of the temple, which is, let me see if I have it here. I think it's like 30 feet across. Yeah. So it's 20 cubits, 30 feet across. But this altar is it's a perfect square, but it's 30 feet across. So this is a massive, massive altar on which you can they could perform tons of sacrifices, and that's what's described of Solomon's worship: tons and tons and tons of sacrifices. And so this is just a massive building project, just to convey a little bit of the glory of it. And this still, I don't think, does justice. But everything inside the temple is overlaid with gold. John, I'm not doing this because it's falling off. It's just that it hurts today. John tells me I touch this compulsively. He's a good guy. And if it's not this, I'll touch something else compulsively. So, but inside, everything's covered with gold. It's amazing. And I don't know if you were confused when you read about the cherubim at all. I had to look at this a few times, and I was thinking, are there more cherubs? Like, more cherubim coming into the temple here? Because there's already cherubim, gold cherubim, on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And now there's these massive cherubim in there. Big, huge wooden things. Okay? And their wingspan are each 7.5 feet. And so they go all the way across the temple from wingtip to wingtip. And so this thing is just massively beautiful and ornate and glorious. And really it's this temple that is the height alongside Solomon's wisdom of Israel's glory here. And so you have a kingdom that seems to be set up for great success, great glory. And that's the early description of what we get. And again, it's in terms of the glory of the temple, but also the wisdom of Solomon that's really drawing people in. And when the temple is dedicated here, Solomon gives this long and beautiful prayer. All of chapter 8 would be worth getting into. But the prayer is absolutely beautiful. And Solomon issues this one aspect of the prayer that I'd want to focus on. He gets at it a few different ways, but it's I think the last verse, the closing of the prayer. 1 Kings 8:61, "Let your heart therefore be wholly true." Wholly true. "To the Lord our God, walking in his statutes." And again, that will be described as wholly true, walking like David. Interesting. "Walking in his statutes, keeping his commands as at this day." This is a very appropriate prayer. It's what God expected and wanted for David, what David encourages his son, what God himself, when he met Solomon, encouraged him to do, to follow with all his heart and all his soul. And here Solomon, in the position of supreme leadership, tells the people, we've got to follow the Lord with all our hearts. This half-hearted worship, the syncretism with other religion, having other idols kicking around, that's not going to work. It's got to be the whole heart. And in that prayer, he doesn't suggest that therefore you must be perfect, though that is the measure. He acknowledges in that prayer, you're going to sin because everybody sins. He says that. But when you sin, like David, you've got to turn to the Lord. You've got to turn around. You've got to turn around. And that is a measure of someone who is wholly true. Not someone who is never royally screwed up. Even as a believer. Even as a Yahweh follower. Even as someone who sees the king, past the kings. But someone who, when they sin, they turn with their whole heart to the Lord. And this is a very apt prayer for him to pray, because it's the prayer that he needs for himself as well as for all the people. And God knows this. Coming out of the prayer, God meets Solomon for the second time. And he reiterates the same thing to Solomon. At first he says, you know, I recognize your prayer. This is a wonderful prayer. It's the right prayer. And I will honor it. I will look towards this place. When people turn towards this place to seek my hand and seek my favor, when they turn to me with their whole hearts, I will respond to that. But there's no conversation here. Solomon doesn't say anything back. What starts with God saying, that was a good prayer, ends with, okay, that was a good prayer, but your prayer will need to be followed by faithful actions. The holiest of prayers will not suffice if you will not follow that up. And so he gives this warning. And now it's more explicitly about idolatry. But if you turn aside from following me, Solomon, remember, this is at the peak of his reign. Everything is going awesome. Everything is flooding into Jerusalem. They've got so much gold, they don't know what to do with it. They just build hundreds of golden shields. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I've set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them. What's the other side of this condition? What's the flip? "Then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name." This beautiful, ornate, majestic, world-drawing temple. That's not as important as your heart being devoted to me. And if your heart goes away from me, be darn sure that temple's gone too. And the house that I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. And Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss. And they will say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? And then they will say, because they abandoned the Lord, their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt. How big a deal is that? The God who brings deliverance and the expectation of being wholly true to him. Because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and laid hold on other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. This is a pretty firm warning. And we don't have Solomon expressing anything in return. What we have is more setup. So immediately after this, we have Solomon's other acts described. We have the Queen of Sheba coming in and being blown away by the glory of the temple and especially by the wisdom of Solomon. We have everybody sending 120 talents of gold. I think a talent is like 75 pounds. So just tons of gold coming in. What are some of the descriptions that stuck out to you? If we can get a couple of sort of the height of the glory of this kingdom. What are some of the ones that just stuck out to you of the extremity of the majesty of Israel at this time? Any? Somebody help me out? Silver. What's silver? The silver is like stones. So there was so much silver in the land, it was like as valuable as stones. Just silver, meh. And again, the gold. We have so much gold, let's make shields. And an interesting number here, I don't want to read much into it, but it's not the number I want to see. From chapter 10, verse 14, now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. A lot of gold. Oh, besides that which came from the explorers and the business of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. Whoa. And then you've got exotic animals being shipped in. This house is just, it's difficult to describe. I think it's difficult for us to contemplate the level of success and recognition. But if there was, maybe the description from 1 Kings 10, 23 to 25, thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, mules, so much year by year. And Russ, to your point, 1 Kings 10:27, and the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. I don't know my woods that much, but it sounds like cedar's pretty good. But there was so much of it. And so you have everything going right. And then, it's kind of hard to fathom this drop. It's more difficult to fathom when you consider what the Lord had blessed Solomon with. This extravagant, abundant wisdom. And if this isn't a warning to us, I don't know what would be. The wisest man to ever walk the earth, save Jesus Christ, who told the people they've got to be wholly true. in his old age. And the text makes it sound like it comes on quicker. I think that's intended to come across as a punch. But in his old age, he turns from the Lord, the one who has guarded and prayed for the people not to turn from the Lord. He abandons his first love. Not entirely. Again, this is a warning about mixing. But he gets messy again. It's like a return to the high places and much worse. Because now he's not just going to go to other places of worship. Now he's going to establish new places of worship. And new, not new gods to worship, but new areas to worship other gods. He will build those. The one who built God's temple will build temples and shrines and monuments to other gods. So if this is possible for Solomon, we have to know. We have to know. Who are we? Do we know our hearts? Are we wholly true to our God? Do we know the wicked potential of our hearts? For everyone, there's probably something different, and maybe multiple things that could grab hold of you in this world. Might be money, might be position, might be sex. Might be food and wine, but something. At least one thing wants to grab hold of you. But in our foolishness, however wise we are, even if we're as wise as Solomon, and we're not, we think we cling to things that we desire, but those things cling to us. And those things we cling to, when they cling to us, they drag us away from our pure worship of the Lord. And so this is just a clear warning. We better be careful what we cling to. Even good things can drag us away from our worship of God. For Solomon, it's the ladies. So Solomon gets clingy. There are clear warnings from Moses, from Samuel, that a good king, he cannot. And there's so much generosity given by God. God doesn't even say through those prophets, you can't have multiple wives. He just says, don't go crazy. And if Solomon's not the picture of going crazy with wives, I don't know what is. And the worst part is that he even selects wives from expressly the nations that God told Israel to avoid, including the Hittites. So there's so much generosity in God here. He just says, these seven nations, and this is from Exodus 34, Deuteronomy 7, these nations, okay, this is why it was okay for, and even blessed for Boaz to take Ruth, the Moabite, because the Moabites weren't part of the list, okay? So it's not, we think a lot about the exclusivity of worship, exclusivity of life and making alliances and making marriages. But there's actually a lot of generosity in the Old Testament that we might overlook. You know, marrying the Egyptian wasn't the problem, or the Moabite. But God just says, these seven nations, okay, they're really bad. They will drag you down. I'm telling you, they will drag you down. And Solomon dismisses those warnings, though he would probably pass it along to the next guy. And he just piles up wives. And it's difficult to imagine how anyone can get that many wives. But he piles them to the ceiling. And the Lord's warning comes true. You shall not enter marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after other gods. Now, just to qualify this real quick, this isn't to be read with this angry feminist worldview that, see, the Bible is just against women. No, the problem is not the women. The problem is clearly Solomon not listening to God. It's not that women are dangerous, so that we got to watch out for them, the wily women. But you do have to watch out who you shack up with, who you make alliances with, who you partner with, who you invest with, who you tie your success to and with. Very important. And so, in addition to being mindful of all the people the Lord would allow his people to marry, just understand the emphasis here is not racial, and it's not against women. The issue here is religious. And God demands, God expects, God deserves holy, true people who sin and turn to him. That becomes very difficult when you partner with people who don't even acknowledge your God. Very difficult. And so that warning cannot be more serious here. But of course, it's not heeded by Solomon. And he clings to them. Solomon clung to these in love. Now, clearly, there's reference to the wives that he got so crazy about and the foreign women. Clearly, there's reference there. But it's interesting. The pronoun here for these, he clung to these or held fast to these. The pronoun used there is masculine. Okay, and you wouldn't see that in an English Bible, but it's clear in the Hebrew. And a commentary pointed it to me because I didn't catch it. But Solomon clung to these in love. Well, what's that? We're not confused about Solomon's orientation, okay? So it's not that. When it says he clung to these, masculine plural, it is tying back to the nations, which is a masculine plural prior in the passage, and also to their gods, which is listed as a masculine plural. And that's just got a built-in warning. Now, Solomon did cling to these women, but we have to understand, when we cling to things, again, even good things sometimes, when we cling to them and need them, these things grab hold of us and they rob us of true worship. They bring us to their gods. And so even though it's the women he thinks he's clinging to and he's crazy about, he can't help but cling to their gods. And it's subtle because we can't pick it up in the English, but it's much clearer there in the Hebrew, because he's not clinging to, primarily here, these women, but as a function of clinging to the women, he's clinging to their gods. It's a bit easier to see in a different version, so I appreciate what our Pew Bibles, I know they're not in there right now, but our Pew Bibles would give the verse like this, and it would be a more literal quote of the Old Testament verse. You shall not associate with them. So rather than focusing on the marriage, here it expands. You shall not associate with them. You don't want to establish firm friendship and really partnership with someone who is dead set against your God. You shouldn't associate with them. Neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. And Solomon held fast to these, including their gods. So we're just wise to remember Solomon's prayer here and where things have gone off the rails. Solomon prayed a good prayer. Let your heart, therefore, be wholly true to the Lord our God, walking in his statutes and keeping his commandments as at this day. And that simple phrase, wholly true, wholly true, it becomes a very important phrase throughout Kings. The next time it shows up after his prayer, the very next time it shows up after his prayer, saying, you got to be wholly true, people. You got to do it. And anyone can preach that. Very next time it's used. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true. And so his actions betrayed his prayer and betrayed the Lord. And he was not wholly true, as was the heart of David, his father. And so the warning there is, I really have to be careful what I cling to. This seems like a silly example, but within the last week, I had to return a stupid, well, it's a smartphone, but I'm calling it stupid. It's a stupid smartphone because I loved it so much. I mean, I loved it. The thing could do everything, including turning my heart away from God, which sounds so ridiculous. But the phone, I loved it so much. It was so cool. And the Lord put back upon me a prior sermon exhortation when I was saying, you know, sometimes we ask things of the Lord that we say, it'll bless the ministry. And I was thinking, yeah, this thing can actually become a PC and I can hook it up here instead of using my laptop. I can have my phone, which would be so much easier. No. Like, what is going on in my brain? I'm like, oh, it'll be so much better. And it's $600 for a stupid phone. And my heart started to cling to it. And thank God I realized the thing was clinging to me. And that was just a stupid phone. We can cling to so much. And we've got to be on guard for our hearts. And it might be the stupid little thing. Or it might be the big thing. But guard your hearts. Because God has called us to be holy. Wholly true to him. But consider the standard we are given. Wholly true like who? Wholly true like who? Like David. Have you considered the blessing of that, of God's setting this up as the standard? Wholly true like David. This isn't whitewashing him. This is remembering all he has done, making a big deal about what he has done. But recognizing that amid his sin, he turned. It took a long time. But he turned. He returned to the Lord his God. And he didn't add idols and just keep going and say, oh, it's too late. I'm just going to keep going in this direction. It's too late. I still worship God, but just, I can't really drop this thing at this point. We need to turn. And take comfort, which is intended. Take comfort that the standard of being wholly true to God, given in the Old Testament here, is David, the murderer. David, the census taker. You'll have to read it if you don't know the significance of that. David, the adulterer. Wholly true to God. Is God merciful? Is God awesome? Coming out of this, 1 Kings 11. Let me just read it. I'll try not to talk about it. Pretty much at time. Solomon clung to these in love, picking up from verse 3. He had 700 wives. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. I'm not great at math, but I think that's 1,000. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. This ended up being referred to as the Mount of Offense. You could see the one worship place across from the other. The priests of the Lord God would be looking across at the priests of these other, right across from that beautiful, glorious temple. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away. It's not even because of the wives that he piled up. Like, stupid move, dude. Stupid. But it's not even that, because his heart turned away. What does God want? Your heart turned to him. And we have turny hearts, very, very turny hearts. But he wants us to be in position to turn back. Because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and talked to you about this and had commanded him concerning this thing. I met with you twice. That he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. And so it feels like all is lost, like the conditional in the promise is shredding the entire promise, but it's not. Yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. You say, yeah, it's still lost. That promise is gone. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to you, to your son, for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. And I just want to jump forward really quickly and can end here. John, I know you got to get to the airport. I love you. This is from chapter 15. Just another king. Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam began to reign over Judah. And he reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And now hear the important measuring rod. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life. And we're going, what? Have you read about David? Except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. The Lord is a forgiver of sins. And the Lord, the faithful God who established his promise to David and said a lamp wouldn't go out, he kept that promise. And even when there's not a son sitting on the throne, there is hope that remains for a son to return. And the son of David, who would sit on the throne of David, he would come. This light has come. And this Jesus was wholly true like David and more. Because David, as true as he was and as faithful as he was, could never make the sacrifice that Christ has made for us. He wouldn't pass. But the one who was to come, that lamp that wouldn't go out, that light that wouldn't go out, he is the one who we trust in today and who we celebrate today, King Jesus. Let me close with John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, that is Jesus, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, just as David was not the light, even though he was the standard for the people, because a new standard bearer was coming, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, and today to all who do receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me, ranks before me, because he was before me.' For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." Amen.